that I welcome today's speaker, a young man who has had an illustrious career here at Harvard, and he's not over yet. He's not completely cooked, although he's in the process of being cooked. But he's a man who's given a great deal of thought to his life, his faith, the integration of his faith with much that he does. I am referring to Andrew J. Miller, Harvard class of 2004. Andrew is a senior history concentrator enrolled in the fourth year master's program in Earth and Planetary Sciences. He is the founder and past president of Harvard Friends Scouting. He was recently honored by the Boston Minuteman Council of the Boy Scouts of America with the Silver Beaver Award. And it's an extraordinary award, actually, for exceptional volunteer service to you. Andrew is one of those people who's really given not only his expertise, but his heart for the work that he has done while he's been here at Harvard. On campus, he served on the Undergraduate Council Election Commission and the Memorial Church Grants Committee. He also directs, this is one of my favorite things, why I like to be in his company as much as I can be. He also directs the CPR program for Harvard of the American Red Cross, and he regularly donates not only his time, but his blood. And I always feel when I'm in Andrew's calm, thoughtful presence that everything is all right. And that if anything needs to be done, Andrew's right there. And if someone needs to think carefully and quickly with acumen, and Andrew's there, it's going to be all right. Andrew's talk this morning is part of the Faith in Young Minds series, which is going to be a volume that will see the light of day, and a collection of these many talks that undergraduates have been giving. This is our attempt to bring undergraduate speakers from every religious tradition to the forum to speak about the many ways in which their faith shapes, challenges, and sustains their lives. So please give a warm welcome to Andrew Miller.
Thank you very much, Dr. Austin. I'm delighted to be here with all of you. And I must say that having been an usher now for the past 3 years, I've been well aware of the activities of the Faith and Life Forum, having read about it and heard about it every week in the bulletin and in the greetings. As an undergraduate, though, I found myself completely unable to motivate myself to attend something that begins at the ungodly hour of 9 a.m., especially on a Sunday, the one day of the week where I get to sleep in. So I'm grateful to Dr. Austin for finding a way to motivate me to attend this wonderful forum. And to share a few things with you, and also to enjoy the wonderful refreshments that I'm prepared. So I'd like to talk this morning about my journey to find what God has set me to do in this life on this earth. While my journey to find God's purpose for me is not yet complete, I would like to share with you two purposes that I believe He has for me: service to others and serving as an example for others. In both, I feel God's presence allowing me to do more and giving me more blessings than I deserve in order to do so. I would like in this talk to trace how I have come to these beliefs. While those beliefs have been a long time in coming, I can assure you that this talk will not be as long. And I must offer a brief disclaimer. I like to consider myself a very modest person, and that is likely a very immodest statement to make, but so you have it. So if in this talk I look slightly uncomfortable, it is because I strongly dislike talking about what I have done. And I hope that you will take it not as an immodest statement on my part, but rather with me trying to struggle with why I have done what I have done, and by offering a few illustrations on that part. I also wrote this at 3 a.m. Sort of a joke. I did not start out as a particularly devout person, nor did I set out to be a particularly helpful person. But while here, I found that I enjoyed service and that it improved my relationship with God. So we'll talk first about service. In trying to articulate my feelings and attitudes towards service, I consulted a good friend who described me as, quote, the unseen glue that allows our community to function, unquote. I feel that while overly generous to me, this description does have an illustrative purpose. In all of the clubs and activities where I have served in a leadership-type role, it's always been in a behind-the-scenes support role, not very public, almost unnoticeable, but very important nonetheless, sort of like the old joke about how to tell if anyone notices that you're gone. The simple way is to miss a few car payments and see who notices you then. So the jobs that I perform are visible only if I fail, and I must say that I relish my invisibility. So this recent realization has been a long time in coming, though the signs were there for anybody to see, and in fact, I feel sort of foolish having not seen them until approximately Wednesday afternoon when I was asked to give this talk. Unathletic as a child, and being rather fascinated with rules, procedure, and order, I am a true type A personality, should any of you be wondering, I did not take a traditional role in the recess wiffle ball games in elementary school. Whereas some people were the outfield, way out, some people were the infield, and others were the batters, I was the umpire. A behind-the-scenes job, often unnoticed, unless you are like that first base umpire at Friday night's Red Sox game, who was indeed hit by a ball, which was pronounced fair. So here at Harvard, I'd like to think that I take on sort of the same role in my work with the Undergraduate Council Elections Commission. The commission, a 7-member body, is entrusted with the responsibility of coordinating all elections for the Undergraduate Council, including the September General Delegates election and the much-touted December presidential-vice-presidential election. We're not a very visible group. We do not hold public hearings. But when we fail to operate and function in an effective manner, everyone knows because the election does not happen. And one only has to look at Crimson articles from 2 Decembers ago to see that being the case. But where in this is God? After all, this is the Faith and Life Forum, and all that I've spoken about right now is my life. There's more of that to come, of course, because this is a 30-minute talk. But serving as a lower school umpire, unfortunately, did not bring me closer to God. If anything, it brought me closer to a wiffle ball and anger from my classmates when I pronounced them out. So closeness to God, proximity to God, would come later. In high school, I must admit, I held a number of leadership positions, as you might have suspected, because I'm a Harvard student, and that's what Harvard students do in high school. They do their best to amass as many things on their resume as possible in hopes that the admissions office might find something redeeming in one of the, you know, 2 dozen activities or so. Because I went to a small high school, I was only able to amass 10. However, somehow that shined through. I attribute that to a semi-blind admissions officer. However, why did I hold so many leadership positions in high school? Was it because I felt God's calling to be the editor-in-chief of the newspaper, or, in true form, the proofreader of the yearbook? And the answer is no, I did not feel God's calling at all. I recall looking at the yearbook for 3 years and determining that the people who put in the picture captions were utter morons. The caption would say right, the picture was to the left. The caption would say up, the picture was down. They would misspell names, get the clubs wrong, get the teams wrong. I decided that that was enough. Proofreading the yearbook was an important job. Someone had to do it. And clearly, I was unable to trust anyone else to do it correctly. That is sort of how my experience in high school went. This is an important job. Far too important to be entrusted to someone who will not do it well. I look around me, I see no one willing to do this well. Therefore, I must do it. And now I am here. Did I feel the hand of God then? No, if anything, I felt the annoyance of incorrect picture captions. But I truly felt the presence of God here at the Memorial Church. But I'm getting ahead of myself, so I shall step back for a moment. So this summer, this is actually a very sad weekend for me. because this summer marks the first summer in 6 years that I will not be a member of the summer camp staff at the Burt Adams Scout Reservation in Covington, Georgia. For those of you who recall the television series In the Heat of the Night, that was filmed in Covington, Georgia. For those of you who do not recall the series, you're not really missing very much. So I truly believe that my involvement with Burt Adams has been God's way of making me aware of his purpose for me in a very small sense, and in working through me to effect great change in an otherwise dismal camp program. It is really very difficult to describe what Burt Adams was like before we attempted to change it from what it was. But the best way would be to describe it as a camp that was filled with unachieved potential. 1,200 acres in the middle of the Georgia Piedmont with a very large 87-acre lake was an absolutely beautiful camp. But it had suffered from neglect. And not neglect in terms of facilities. It actually had fairly decent facilities. It suffered from neglect in terms of program and in terms of staff. And if you are a 15-year-old and you have the option of working at one of two camps, Atlanta, the Boy Scouts there, had two summer camps, one up in the North Georgia Mountains, one in the Georgia Piedmont. You'd want to choose the one where you have most fun, because you're 15, and you're not being paid very well to work at scout camp, so you may as well have fun while doing so. So you choose the camp with the better program, which means that the camp with the worst program has much more difficulty finding staff. Therefore, they accept subpar staff, which, extraordinarily enough, leads to subpar programs. Which means that the next summer, when the rumors are about how the camp has a terrible program, they are yet still unable to find good staff. It's sort of a descending spiral. My first interaction with summer camp staff was in 1997, when I served on the staff of a leadership camp in Atlanta. And my role there was to stay as far away from the summer camp staff as possible, because they were a rather mean, jealous, and bitter group. They did their best to thwart everything that we did, and we did our best to avoid them, so as to avoid being thwarted. And so, after 2 years of sort of enduring what they decided to throw at us, three of us decided that we would join summer camp staff and perhaps give them a helping hand and attempt to convince them that the few people who invaded their camp for 1 week every summer were not as bad as they thought we were. So for 1 year, we sort of battled against the inevitable, made our small scout craft area the best that it could be. But in the large perspective of the camp, the unachieved potential, it did not make much of a difference. It was only with the arrival of new management that things began to turn around. So, let's see. I, of course, needed a summer job the following year, and I came back. And there, much like the umpire and election commission role, they found the perfect invisible job for me. I was the camp registrar. It was my job to juggle the schedules of approximately 150 campers each week, each taking three different classes, and to produce class rosters and balance out the classes so that one class did not have 10 while the other had 4, to make it a nice even 7. This I did with great skill. And that's probably, hopefully, the most immodest that I shall be in this talk. So I like to feel that I performed that job very well, and that it allowed small improvements to be made, but the program that needed the most improvement was the first-year camper program. And to fully understand how terrible this program is, I have to tell you just a bit about the people who both run it and who participate in it. So the people who run it, Rawhide is the name of the program, after that wonderful TV show, I believe. I show my age and that I have no idea actually what decade it comes from. But Rawhide, nonetheless, is what it was. And the purpose of Rawhide is to take 11-year-olds who have just entered the Boy Scout program from Cub Scouts and teach them basic scouting skills. How to use a compass, how to tie a square knot, how to cook a meal, how to camp overnight. But recall that Burt Adams is the camp of unachieved potential. So if you have a choice as to which camp you are going to go to with your troop, you likely will not choose Burt Adams, because you will want the camp with a better program. So what Atlanta does, Atlanta has a very large Scout Reach program. Scout Reach is a program that brings disadvantaged youth off of the street. streets and into the scout troops. And one of the things they do every summer is they take them out to scout camp. And since program retention is actually very low, every year about all of them are in the first-year camper program. But they suffer from a lack of adult supervision, such that I have two favorite typical stories. They're actually dreadful stories, but they will give you a sense of what this program, unfortunately, has to deal with. Every so often, they go to the rifle range. Every so often, a young man gets disgruntled and will point his rifle at the instructor. Fortunately, it is not loaded, but we did have an instance where a rifle was dry fired at an instructor. And then we had the following incident where the sheriff came and spoke to the child and drove him back to Atlanta. And then we took the kids to the archery range, where two of them got in a rather heated argument, and with drawn bow and arrow, turned to face each other, and again argued. So you have an idea as to the difficulties that any instructor in this program might face when it comes to dealing with these youth, who, through really no fault of their own, are placed in a terrible situation, in that their home situation is not that good, they've really never been out of the city, and all of a sudden here they are, in the middle of camp. They're not quite sure how to handle the deer. Are they going to eat the deer? Are the deer going to eat them? This is a major concern for them, as I can testify to having counseled many a kid about this. So those are the kids in the program. The staff is even worse. When you think of a summer camp and the things that you have to staff, the first thing you want to staff is the things that require the most skill. The rifle and archery ranges, for example. You're not going to put nimwits on the rifle and archery staff because a mistake there could cost lives. Same with the aquatic staff. You wouldn't want to put someone who had no idea about nature in the nature lodge, nor would you really want to put someone who didn't know a football from a volleyball on the sports staff. On the climbing tower, you'd better have people who know how to climb. What does that mean? That means rawhide. You have to have a certain number of bodies to run camp, and those bodies were not useful anywhere else, would end up in the program I ran. So something needed to change. And my work there, which I believe was really motivated by the Almighty, in the sense that he gave me the inspiration to do so, and the skill to carry it through, was to completely revamp the program. Over the course of two summers, I wrote a 160-page booklet. There was a staff guide with syllabi, lesson plans, materials lists, and really everything in between, so that you can give this book to anyone who has the right skill set. By that I mean, who knows how to tie knots, use a compass, and they can run a stellar first-year camper program. This book is now used nationally by the Boy Scouts of America, showing people what first-year camper programs should be like. And Bert Adams is making a strong change, so that now there are troops that come specifically to Bert Adams. They understand it has a stellar program, a stellar first-year camper program. I truly believe that God, working through me, was able to effect this change, which has not only influenced the lives of inner-city youth in Atlanta, but also suburban and rural youth in the Atlanta area, but also youth from across the country, because my program has fortunately been used as a model for a number of first-year camper programs. So I feel very, very grateful and very, very humbled that such an action could be achieved through my hand, which I feel is a very, very unworthy hand to be working through. So God gave me inspiration, thoroughness, and drive so that I could finish my task of writing this program and directing it. But I didn't realize that until I came here. Here at Memorial Church, I discovered the connections that have been present all along, service and faith. My service to others strengthened my faith, which increased my resolve to do, as Christ says in Matthew 20:26. Whosoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant. I wish for greatness in spirit, and thus I serve gladly. When we pray, as we often do before sermons or the branch committee, take our hands and work through them, take our lips and speak through them, take our minds and think through them, and take our souls and set them on fire for Christ's sake, I renew my commitment to being an instrument of God's will. And one day, I realized I'm actually good at organizational tasks. I enjoy the challenge and minutia of support jobs. Perhaps when I do them, God is working through me. This is certainly what I pray for. The Reverend Dr. Austin spoke very briefly about the Silver Beaver Award that I was humbled to receive on May 8th. I received that mostly for my work with the Merit Badge University here at Harvard, which every year brings about 250 Boy Scouts to Cedar Hall for two Saturdays where they work on the new Merit Badge. I think that the Merit Badge University is a very good example of my service while being another good example of how it is not very visible service. First of all, if you were to ask any undergraduate, likely they'd never heard of the Merit Badge University. If you ask any students at the Merit Badge University, likely they had never heard of me. This is fantastic. My entire job was to convince people to teach and then to be the registrar. I'd already known how to be a registrar. That was not difficult. And finding people willing to teach was not as difficult as I thought either. If I do my job well, hundreds of young scouts will be further on their trail to Eagle. Behind-the-scenes job, but as I mentioned, a complex one. I believe that God gave me strength to see it through, and the reward that I feel just watching the program in action is immense. Standing out in Seaver Hall, just in the hallway, when the classes change, and seeing hundreds of 250 smiling young faces come out of the classes and go into another class sort of reminds me of a middle school in some sense. And I truly understand how people there feel so much satisfaction in the job that they do just by watching the children go from classroom to classroom with their smiling faces. But here at Memorial Church in the Grants Committee, here it is that it has truly made me more aware of the links between faith and service. Because it is our faith on the Grants Committee that brings us to serve. And I doubt that I can imagine another instance of service that I will perform where I don't recall Jim Lawson's faithful and pious running of the committee. There the work that we do is for Christ. We find the charities that need our help here in the congregation most, and we do our best to assist them with that. It is powerful work, it is prayerful work, and it is a service to the community that has truly reinforced my devotion towards God, and I feel that from my devotion towards God, I get more strength to perform the work of the community, which is very difficult when you have 100 worthy charities and can only afford to support approximately 40 of them. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. So I serve because I truly want to be helpful. For example, I give blood. I dislike needles. I'm very anxious about giving blood, but I finally resolved in November that to give blood I would. And though my veins are sometimes difficult to find, which very unfortunately often results in multiple pokes, to find the vein, I believe it's important to do as much as I can to help others. And so I give blood. And I pray every time I give blood that it be useful to someone and that it help save a life or make a surgery successful, or do whatever it is supposed to do, and that it not get lost along the way, or unfroze it, or that somehow I'm not an engineer, or I not have any infectious diseases that I encounter along the way. That would have to be tragic. But I truly want to make a positive difference, and I have no compunction about not being noticed for the positive difference that I make. The organizations that I choose to assist are not very public organizations. The Harvard Friends of the American Red Cross is not a very public organization. I will be teaching CPR after the service today to the ushers. We, every so often, I'm sure that you all are delighted to hear that, even though I'm sure that none of you will ever require our services. I'm also very happy to be working with the Boy Scouts in a non-public role. I'm not a troop leader. I serve on a committee where I say very little. And I serve with the Merit Badge University, where I say very little but do many good things. And that, to me, is what is the most powerful, that one does not have to be recognized for one's service to make a large difference. And I can tell you that as honored as I was to receive the award from the Boy Scouts, be just as happy were I not to seek it. And I don't think that I would value my accomplishments any less, nor would I see the hand of God not be in it, because certainly the hand of God is in it, because it's allowed me to do far more than I deserve to do by myself. So that is the first purpose, I think, that God has to serve others in a quiet, unassuming way, in a way that is useful to community, and in a way that furthers his message and purpose. The second is perhaps the one where I thought, where I run the most risk of being immodest. And I believe that it is my purpose to draw others to Christ simply by serving as a good example. It is not my intent to proselytize. Others are much better at looking up Bible verses. I'm an Episcopalian, which is sort of peruse the interesting bits. So I'm certainly very poor at coming up with Matthew 20:26, but sort of flipping through the Bible and noticing the word servant. So you can see the method that Episcopalians move through to find Bible verses. Certainly the book of Revelation gets a lot of thumbing through. But it is my hope that by living my life in a way of prayerful service, that I can inspire others around me to be more aware of the powerful good that they have within themselves, and the potential that we all have to serve others and further God's kingdom. If I am lucky, I will bring one or two to Christ through my actions. If I am extraordinarily lucky, I will make my community a better place. And that is what I pray for, and that's what I hope you all pray for. So I thank you for your time. Hope that it's been at least entertaining. It's certainly been very, very helpful for me to articulate these feelings that have been in me for a long time, but have not gone recognized either by me or by others. So thank you very much. I'm looking for full-time employment. I have a couple applications out. I would like to be a high school teacher. So there are four. I don't have a public school certification, though, so there are four private schools that are currently considering me. There's a possibility that I might end up working for NASA. It's very unclear. Over the summer, until I do find a full-time job, I'm supposed to be here turning my thesis into a paper. Hopefully that will all work out.
Will you tell us what your thesis is on, please?
Of course. So I'm a fourth-year master's candidate in geology, and my focus there is paleontology. So my thesis is on a 570-million-year-old marine invertebrate called Cloudina. Cloudina, the best way to envision it, is as a series of concentric test tubes. And it's been known since 1972, but no one really knows that much about it. And my thesis was to figure out what it looked like. So we take a rock with Cloudina in it, let's say a 3-centimeter-thick rock. We smooth it out, and we scan it into the computer. Then we grind off a 20th of a millimeter, and we scan that into the computer. Then we repeat this 567 times, 12 minutes a cycle, lots of time over at MIT in the lab, and we have 567 images, each of which is a 20th of a millimeter apart, that has black fossil material and sort of grayish rock material. And so from that, I can put it into the computer, and the computer can figure out which is fossil and which is rock, and it can build a 3D reconstruction of the fossil. So what we have is a much more complete picture of what Cloudina looks like, because before that all you had were cross-sections. And cross-sections can be wonderfully informative. For example, if you wanted a cross-section of me, you could just slice me down the head, but you'd get an inaccurate section that you wouldn't see my leg. Now imagine if I was sort of contorted. If you slice me down here, you're not going to get the full picture either. So that's what the 3D image is so useful, in that it's not associated with any bias in the rock record in terms of the fossil orientation. So that's what I did, and my thesis is both presenting these images that took hundreds of hours to compile, and also telling what implications come from those images. For example, it's likely not a mollusk. It's likely not a coral. It's more likely a worm. So I spent 200 hours or so discovering that this nice little fossil that created a shell. The lowly worm. But the lowly worm that caused us all to had lots of guitar playing in the congregation. And then we moved, and I attended the Lovett School. If any of you recall, Ricky Chenal, Ricky and I carpooled together in elementary and middle school. We went to the same school. And there was a church service every Wednesday. And so my mother decided that we only needed to go to church once a week. So we stopped going to Sunday. I think it was a clever ploy on her part. We stopped going to church at all on Sunday. And it was just my brother and I who went to church at school on Wednesday. There I served in the vestry in eighth grade. But I believe that is because of my... as I mentioned, I was somewhat unathletic. And as such, I tended to get picked on, and therefore, in a bizarre schoolyard version of what I'm sure goes on in the African savannah, I befriended those much more powerful than my enemies, which is to say the teachers. And so I fixed their computers, and in return, they wanted me to be on the vestry. So I was on the vestry. It brought me closer in proximity to God, but not in a very spiritual way, mostly in a geographic location, in that I was up near the altar. Then I went off to boarding school, Mercersburg Academy, which is the United Church of Christ boarding school in South Central Pennsylvania. My grandparents lived 3 miles away, and they decided the best way for them to see me would be if they were to attend the 11 o'clock church services every Sunday. I did not realize that they were doing so, and thus I slept through the 11 o'clock church services every Sunday until consistent guilt tripping by the school minister caused me to not only attend, but then I joined the choir there. It's truly here that I think I've felt the most spiritual that I have. And part of that is because I'm not as regular as Bill Crowd is at morning prayer, but I like to think that, you know, I'm sort of three-quarters of the person he is attending now. I became an usher here at the church because Ricky needed help. I first joined the festival choir as a freshman, and I continued halfway through sophomore year until I had to give it up to attend Boy Scout meetings. But then I became a member of the congregation, and Ricky, who carpooled with me, and rightfully so, can ask me to do really any favor that he needs for having endured with our carpool, asked me whenever they were short of an usher to join up. And then my former roommate became the head usher, and it just sort of made a complete transition, because he always asked me to help. So I used to call myself were the usher corps like Marines, I would be a reservist, but no longer, because I'm active with them. So my spiritual journey has really been one that has intensified here. I mean, God has always been a part of my life, but it is truly here that I felt his presence and his power. Okay.
You say you moved to Hong Kong.
Yes.
Your family did, or
yes.
You?
My family did. I went to boarding school in Pennsylvania. So I visited on vacations.
That's when you went to boarding school.
Yes.
She
wants to know what family in Hong Kong, everyone else.
So my father is a lawyer, and he does international utilities law, which is a truly interesting subject to only a small number of people.
Are you alone now?
I find it fascinating what my father is able to find interesting. And so the law firm that he works for, there's a large energy company based out of Atlanta called Southern Company. They own all these power plants, power companies in the southeast. And they had a subsidiary called Southern Energy, which worked in the deregulated markets. And Asia had one of the largest energy market potentials, you know, needed a lot of development there. So Southern Energy began to do a lot of purchasing in China, in Hong Kong, in the Philippines, in that area. And the law firm decided that it would be best positioning for them if they were to open up an office in Asia so as to help their clients. So I think my dad is number 8 on the list of people who they thought would be a good candidate, but numbers 1 through 7 absolutely had no interest in moving to Hong Kong. And my dad, I recall that when he was growing up, his father moved to New Zealand with the family for a few years to be a chemist at a tire company, at a tire plant there. So he wasn't as averse to the idea of moving abroad for part of our childhood than others. So off we went to Hong Kong. Dad served as the first resident partner of the firm's office. He's actually the only one of two lawyers there. This is how you got the big straw and they determined who was who in the position. I went to boarding school in Pennsylvania. My brother attended a local private school run by the Missouri Synod of the Lutheran Church. We were there for 2.5 years. I visited on vacation, so I got the fun parts of Hong Kong without having to endure these dreadful temperatures and humidity. It's really the humidity that's awful. Basically along the same line of latitude as is Havana. that'd be dreadful if he's not. But that's why I'm here.
And your brother was in school here or there?
My brother was in 7th and 8th grade in Hong Kong. And then when I was a senior at boarding school, he was a freshman. And that fall, my family was back. My dad got a different job for the company that he's now kept from. It's just financial restructuring bankruptcy. He's actually still being paid. They have a power plant in Kendall Square, so if somehow you can possibly leave your lights on, then my family would be most grateful. I used to always be a stickler about turning off the lights. And I'm fortunate in that I have found roommates, people who are not such sticklers. So I simply let them leave last, and then I don't feel badly about leaving the lights on. And my family's financial well-being is made somewhat more stable. So if you live in the same area as Kendall Square or surroundings, I encourage you to leave a light on for my father. Possibly the entirety of the lights in your house. And it would not hurt to add Christmas lights outside.
Anyway, one more question. Are you a chip off two blocks?
Chip off two blocks. I'm certainly more like my father in terms of sense of humor. Than my mother. My mother endures my father's puns. My father attempts to make them at every opportunity possible. My favorite recollection of this night, I apologize in advance, is that we were in Eagles Mirror, Pennsylvania, very lovely sort of mountain resort type town for the summer, and every July 4th they have their history parade. And the float, and the parade begins with the Historical Society's float, and it ends with the Historical Society's float. They just sort of loop around. And as they loop around again, my father calls out for everyone to hear, "History repeats itself." The laughter, at least on my part, was difficult to contain. The groans on my mother's part were also difficult to contain. So I think in terms of sense of humor, I take far more from my father than from my mother. But in terms of the idea of service to others, I think I take equally from both of them. My mother has been more involved in volunteer activities, but certainly without the support that my father was able to provide and the encouragement, especially when she was in charge of the Christmas parade. You'd never imagine the sort of thought that has to go into running a Christmas parade. Not every street is suitable. For example, you have the street with the lights that hang out. All those have to be moved to the side. You can't move them to the side because you can't have the parade there. But with all of that that she had to deal with, I'm very grateful to my father for providing that support. So I suppose I am, in a sense, the chip off of two blocks. But my humor is only a chip off of my father's block. So I only see these campers for a week at a time. That's how long the session is. Bert Adams only runs 3 sessions. Our sister camp up in North Georgia Mountains runs 9, where they have approximately 1,000 kids a week. We run 3, but with about 150. And the way that the program works is that I only see them for that 1 week, because when they graduate to the next level, they get sent to the other camp. So there's actually no way for me to trace them through the program. I see small changes over the course of the week. Usually they get over their homesickness, they get over some of the anger and belligerency that they have. Last summer, I was blessed to have on my staff one of the few success stories of the program, Antonio. And he came through, I think he went to Woodruff for his first year camper program. Woodruff means another camp. But he was just a fantastic example of the success that the program can have. And in terms of the religious involvement, a lot of times these sort of Operation First Class Scout Beach programs are sponsored by a church, but the youth who attend are not necessarily members of that church. It's sponsored by an inner city urban church as a service to the community. It's it's to the point where actually the Boy Scouts are unable to find adult leadership for the troops. They actually have to employ people full time to be the scoutmasters, and that's very difficult for them because there's usually only one adult and like 80 children. It's a very awkward situation for them to be in. So I don't notice most of the kids that I deal with in this program being devout churchgoers, nor do I really notice them paying special attention when it comes time for vestry or something else. But hopefully, if they have a good experience in the program and they stick with it, that they will find some form of reverence through that. So that's the hope.
Thank you so much. I'm reminded, of course, of a biblical verse. He was just Episcopalian and having rifled through as a youth, but in my youth I was a Baptist, so I got very proficient at sword drills and beating the other kid up, first kid to the Bible verse, to be able to find it. Let your light so shine before others that they may see your good works. Glorify your Father. I think this is the verse I would put in your Bible. If I were giving you a Bible. So I'm going to give you a Bible before you. And I want to say, may the Lord watch between me and thee as we are absent one from another. And I hope when you're the headmaster of the extraordinary school, I hope you won't forget us, and you'll send out an invitation to all of us to come to your installation so that we can sit there on the floor and say, yes, we knew him when he was exactly what he is today, a little younger, now he's a little more so, and so on. Well, very good. Let us not tarry to get to divine service, but let's have a word of assistance. Dear Lord, we come before you with grateful hearts. The youth of the world who reshape what we have done, who make the future a more promising place. Give to them wisdom, courage, insight, energy, dedication, and good faith. But to us, dear Lord, give us your peace and guide this day and forevermore. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. See you in church.